Welcome to Impossible Podcasts. Space opera. For decades, it's been the bread and butter of science fiction, the well-trodden borderland where genre meets the mainstream. From Star Wars to Blake 7, via Lost in Space, Babylon 5, Farscape, Firefly, the list is almost endless. So why is space opera dying a death on screen? For the first time in living memory, there are no new spacefaring TV series in production, and, with a few notable exceptions, Hollywood is giving alien worlds a wide berth. Perhaps books can lead the way. The market for space opera on the printed page has never been stronger, and if anyone can see the future, it's a collection of best-selling sci-fi authors. And that's exactly who gathered together at this year's SFX Weekender event in North Wales. Paul McCauley, Peter F. Hamilton, Alistair Reynolds, Dan Abnett, Jane Fenn, Mike Cobley, and Aaron Dembski Bowden put their heads together to see if the printed page might once again hold the key to sci-fi's future. They were all very passionate, and let slip the occasional swear word, so be warned. It's also worth noting that the panel was held a stone's throw from the bar, so there is some background noise, but it never intrudes too much, and this remains essential listening for anyone with an interest in science fiction. Let's hear what the panelists had to say.
Good to have you here. Thank you, everyone. We're going to talk about space opera. We'll get into the definitions in a minute, and that'll take about 45 minutes to clear up, then we can all go. But I'd like to begin with, I'm going to ask my panelists to introduce themselves. We have an extra panelist on the end, my friend Paul McCauley. So, Paul, would you like to start, just a brief introduction?
Paul McCauley, used to write radicals, hard science fiction space opera. I have no idea what that is, so I stopped. And my latest book's In the Mouth of the Whale, which is kind of space opera. Got battles in the atmosphere of a gas giant. I think that counts.
I have my own. I'm Peter F. Hamilton. I also write space opera, quite large ones. And the latest book, which I've just delivered, is Great North Road, which is also sort of space opera. It's more of a horror space opera, but I'm interested to see what the definition is of space opera, so I'll await judgment on that.
I'm Al Reynolds. I've written quite a bit of science fiction, I suppose, is sort of vaguely space opera-ish. I have a background in science, which I suppose colours the type of science fiction I do. My most recent novel is Blue Remembered Earth, which has just come out, and it is actually my attempt to get a bit away from space opera. So I think later on I'd like to talk a little bit about the way we tend to apply the label of space opera to anything that's got spaceships in, which I think is maybe a bit of a mistake.
I'm Dan Abnett. I write for Black Library and for Angry Robot, and also comics extensively. And a lot of the Black Library stuff in particular that I write might be labelled space opera. It is in its purest form shooty death kill in space.
So. I'm Jane Fenn. I'm author of the Hidden Empire series, the most recent book of which, Bringing of Light, definitely space opera because it involves going to another galaxy and a lot of shit gets blown up.
What? Yeah, blown up? Alright. My name's Mike Cobbler. I'm the... What the hell am I again? Right, okay, I have written a fantasy trilogy at one point, but I'm now an official science fiction space opera writer, and I've written the Humanity's Fire trilogy. And going by the stormtroopers around here, I must also be a piece of rebel scum. So there you go.
Best people
are. Yeah, Tom. My name is Aaron Dembski Bowden, and like Dan, I am currently being published by Black Library because they pay insanely well. And I'm on this panel despite being an idiot because they said, would you like to be on a panel with Peter F. Hamilton? And I said, yeah. Nice to meet you.
to the meat of the panel. Well, the topic is space opera, but the sort of subtopic is there's no space opera on television. There's none coming up in the cinema. So is literary space opera, the stuff in books, carrying the flag for the genre? And that's what we're going to talk about. But before we get into that, we have to be clear about what we mean by space opera. And this is one of those things that really just, you know, just drives you nuts. You know, just that science fiction's endless obsession with definitions and sub-definitions and, you know, just it's mental. So I'm going to cut through all that and I'm going to issue the ultimate definition of space opera. I think that no one really said it better than Brian Aldiss when he said it's basically widescreen Baroque. That basically tells you everything you need to know. And I'll amplify that a little bit by saying that it's basically science fiction with an interstellar setting, probably, but not necessarily always. Generally, the action will take place on other planets, usually more than one other planet. There'll be some kind of power struggle, some kind of political situation where you've got, you know, large groups of good guys against large groups of bad guys, be it galactic empires versus rebels, that kind of thing. And I think as well, it's important there should be a lot of colour and panache, adventure, spectacle, a sense of melodrama. It's science fiction in technicolour. It's not subtle. It's science fiction turned up to 11. So that's my definition of space opera. And as moderator, this is beyond contestation. We in literary science fiction, in written science fiction, there's been some would say a resurgence in space opera over the last perhaps two decades from the 90s. There's a lot of talk about something called new space opera. And I was going on panels about new space opera 15 years ago, and we're still talking about it. It's almost as if we would, you know, if you were in music circles, it would be like talking about skiffle in the 80s, you know, and it's that and that. But anyway, we're still talking about space opera, and people are still writing it. But has space opera died away from the visual media? Is there space opera on television? Is there space opera in the cinema? And I suppose the question I'd like to put to my panelists is, really, has there ever been much of it to begin with? Are we sort of romanticising a past when there was loads and loads of space opera in the cinema? I'm not sure there was. So perhaps I could begin with Aaron. What do you think?
I really wish I prepared for this now. I was Wikipediaing on my phone this morning. What is space opera? No, I think we probably are romanticising a golden age that never existed. Because beyond Star Wars, I can't actually think of that many space opera films that I saw in the cinema. I mean, was the last Starfighter in the cinema, or did it suck too much? I can't even remember. I was four. That's the way. I'll be on the stars. I vaguely remember that one. But no, I don't. Practically all science fiction in my life has come through books. Hardly any of it's been through the cinema. Occasionally, it's been on TV. But you know, that always gets cancelled. So.
I seem to remember Lucas saying that one of the reasons he made the Star Wars films was because he wanted to sort of kick off a wave of that type of film. But it really never happened, did it? I mean, there were films like Battle Beyond the Stars, but it was nothing ever picked up the momentum of the Star Wars films. Mike?
I think that the original Star Wars trilogy certainly defined a kind of a visual flavour that wasn't there before, much in the same way that the prequel trilogy defined a sense of idiocy in plotting that didn't exist before on the big screen. I feel that we don't have anyone carrying the banner on TV anymore. Babylon 5 is gone. Firefly, criminally cancelled, and Farscape was tremendous while it was hammering along, and Battlestar Galactica, a tremendous series ruined by the last half hour. Oh yes, that was possibly the worst last half hour of a major series I've ever seen on TV. And actually, I wrote an actual true ending to the Battlestar Galactica series, and it's online. I wish I printed the damn thing out and brought it along and bored you with it. But
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that we're going to see another big TV series, certainly in the current economic climate. It may have to wait the 2020s or something.
It's interesting that you mentioned Battlestar Galactica, because I put that in a slightly different bracket. Yes, we've got spaceships, yes, we've got other planets, but the sort of overall tone of it is, for me, it's too dark, too claustrophobic to qualify as space opera. Yeah, but maybe we'll get into that a bit later. Jane?
I agree with the other panellists that Star Wars is our sort of benchmark, whether we like it or not, do like it. I think television is much better as a medium for space opera because you can explore a lot more, and it is a shame that series like Farscape and Battlestar Galactica and Firefly did get cancelled. I think this is a temporary thing. Alison, let me see the questions, but I do think this is a temporary thing, and I think it's partly to do with our disillusionment with space exploration, the fact that it didn't quite work out the way we were hoping. I'm trying not to say too much in case it's something we're going to come on to, because there's been a perception that in hard economic times escapism is big, and yet strangely that's not happening. All these cancelled series, nothing new coming up. So I think the real world might be getting in the way of our space opera, damn it.
I think Star Wars gets mentioned very much because it is such an obvious benchmark of that sort of stuff, and it was a technical benchmark, I think, as much as anything else, because it created an entirely believable world or set of a universe, and then rendered the action within that universe on a scale that we had not seen before. And it amuses me that Lucas was in the 40s and stuff like that, which to him was a golden age of space opera, which of course had never been technically perfected in the way that he did it. And the reason that I think there wasn't much afterwards is because no one could quite do it that way. I mean, he cornered the market in the way the sort of language of the special effects work. And I know space opera clearly is something where there are a component of story and character in a very, very important way, but it is also it's the delivery mechanism of the scale and action that I think defines space opera as opposed to other forms of space-based science fiction. And that's probably why we see less of it in television and film since, and that's why it's persisting and is, I think, very vital in books, is because we've got a bigger budget than most television shows. When you're writing a novel, you can do things that simply no one can manage the scale of. And I also think, just if I ramble on a bit, it's simply the idea that a lot of the films that are coming on at the moment, I think, are sort of space opera in disguise. You think about a lot of the sort of very entertainment-orientated movies that are coming up in the next year or so, things like, I don't know, Battleships as a movie, or the Transformers movies. Now, I'm not suggesting they are high art by any stretch of the imagination, but they contain within them the essence of what a good space opera would often have, which is extremely good special effects on an enormous scale, with lots of things blowing up in a very, very convincing fashion, driven along by a dynamic plot about, you know, people running from one place to another for some plot item. And I think that, in fact, it's the setting that's changed. We are finding ways of putting that kind of escapism in Earth-based scenarios because we're no longer reliant on mechanical special effects. We use computer animation. And therefore, you can, you know, destroy New York many, many times. And it's no longer a completely unsurmountable obstacle. So I think space opera is actually existing in cinema in a way that isn't immediately recognisable as space opera.
And I suppose to some extent, something like the Pirates of the Caribbean films also sort of, yeah. I mean, because you've got travel, you've got ships, you've got different locations.
Absolutely,
like it's crazy characters.
Space opera without the space part, it is equally fantastical and baroque, so I think, yeah.
Perhaps more palatable to the general audience.
Yeah. I think there is that, the opera part of space opera is the melodrama, and that's always sort of, you know, writ large. So, things like Star Trek and Farscape and Firefly, which Firefly particularly adore, were almost, although they met many of the criteria, they're much more character driven. They're about people and situations, and often didn't have the wherewithal to do the ridiculous exploding galaxy moment that a space opera really needs to have to punctuate it.
I think my sort of benchmark is if you don't have a scene in a space opera where the entire fate of the universe, or at least the empire, depends on two characters having a sword fight on the bridge of a battle cruiser in flames crashing through an atmosphere, then it's not space opera.
You're not trying.
You're not trying hard. Peter.
Given Brian Blessed is one of the guests, I'm surprised nobody's mentioned Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
Okay, point.
Let's do a live. On three. One, two, three.
God is alive!
Okay, moving on. I'm going to slightly disagree with you on the reason nobody makes it anymore. Because we've got the computer-generated special effects, anything is visual. Anything I write is doable visually. One of the reasons none of my stuff ever gets put on the screen is I've had some fabulous lunches with producers who've heard of me and have heard that I write space opera, and then one of my books sort of bonks down in front of them, and they look at it and go, oh. Because the characters, because we all have the multiple characters, because we all have the fate of the galaxy or the fate of the planet, and then there's politics and love stories and fights, and it all intertwines, and it's very, very big. All of us tell very big stories. Now, visually, we can do them, and quite cheaply with computer graphics, but you can't cram our kind of books into 2 hours. And that's one of the big problems that we get from this. I was thinking about this when I saw the title of the panel. And as far as I know, I think Hyperion's under pre-production. I know the Honorverse is. I think somebody bought the Foundation trilogy 2 or 3 years back. It will be an interesting couple of years coming, whether these actually ever make it out of pre-production. But there's certainly the will is there somewhere. People have latched onto these books, and now we can, as I say, now we can do the special effects. They're starting to think in these kind of terms. So I've not given up hope entirely for seeing space opera back on the screen.
Is it your aspiration that you see your own books, or is that not your concern?
Yeah, sure, I'd love to go and see it, but you always hear of authors coming out of the premiere going, well, that's not what I wrote. And there's a very good reason for that, and this is two entirely different mediums of storytelling. If one of my books was to be filmed, then a hell of a lot would have to be cut out of it. So I'd get to see various little story threads, which would be nice, but I would have to go into it knowing that a lot of it would be sacrificed. So that's the kind of devil's bargain you make. So probably yes, because they pay quite well.
It is a historical curiosity that the studios in the 30s and 1930s and 40s, you have to say 1930s and 40s now, didn't make any space opera, because they're certainly making lots of historical operas, and they're certainly doing things which were special effects driven, like Wizard of Oz. But they didn't pick up any of the proper old stuff that Brian Aldiss referred to in the Wise Greenborough, old space opera novels and novellas. It would have been very different if Hollywood had, I think. And imagine, Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone having a sword fight in space. That would be lovely. But they just didn't. And there were a few off-world things turned up in the 50s and 60s, but it didn't really get going. Yeah, Forbidden Planet, but it's not really space opera, is it? It's space, yeah. It's not really widescreen. It's Robinson Crusoe, in a sense, with robots. But there's stuff around. I mean, I'm surprised nobody mentioned Star Trek, because I thought the Star Trek reboot was a bit space opera-ish. You had giant spaceships crashing. You had a fight between the antagonist and the protagonist for the fate of a planet. Although Star Trek, the original stuff, was very bureaucratic. It was like, it was the anti-romantic way, in a way. It was all form-ticking and the rules and things you shouldn't do. It had the Prime Directive and all that. But the later one is a lot more, and some of the films are a lot more swashbuckling, I thought, there's even one where they did turn into pirates in space. So there was space opera, and I thought the Doctor Who Christmas special, the sort of setup at the beginning, was like, there was a whole space opera story off screen. We saw the last 2 minutes of it before we plunged into the Earth in the rather disappointing, I hate to say, takeoff of C.S. Lewis and The Wood Between the Worlds later on. So this sort of space opera at the end, and I think, it could do all those fabulous sets in the 1940s for The Wizard of Oz. It certainly can do and do the Transformers movies and all the rest of it, and the Die Hard movies and all the big action movies. There's no reason why it can't do space opera, but except people haven't, for some reason, decided there's a market for it after Star Wars. Maybe it's Star Wars' fault. Discuss.
And I think that's it's a good point about that Paul makes about the recent Star Trek film, and I think in some respects it almost undermines the premise, because we know there's another one coming. It's a bit of a surprise to me that they've taken as long as they have to follow up on, you know, what was a very commercially successful reboot. The next one's coming out next year, I think. But, you know, it's a hell of a gap between films. But perhaps if those films had been, the gap had been a bit less, we wouldn't be having this discussion, because the perception would be that there is cinematic space opera out there. There's also something like Avatar. It touches, you know, it has something of the scope of space opera at times. Yes, it's confined to one planet, but in terms of the aerial battles there, it's fully space operatic. So perhaps, you know, it is out there, but it's maybe just a bit more dilute than we'd like. You know, the gaps between the films are a bit longer.
Is it actually a question, though, of scale that we're sort of underestimating? I think Peter's point is well made, that the scale of the book in terms of the story, the plot dynamics, and the characters are often won't fit into the space of a movie. Which is fair enough. I mean, what would be lovely to see is a sort of something the length of The Killing, you know, 20-hour-long episodes, which has the budget to do the special effects well enough, but also the space to do the characterization well enough. But I wonder also, something like Avatar, grandiose though it is still finding a way of limiting what we're seeing in terms of the actual spectacle, because the great thing about space opera in science fiction, in literature, is that you can in using words, describe and communicate something that you could never possibly actually see, because the distances involved are often too great, or the sheer scale of things are too great. You would never have any kind of perspective or overview via a cinema screen to understand what the hell was going on in a space battle. But you can in a book, and that's why I think, you know, something like Transformers, which you can reduce it down to robots beating the shit out of each other in the city, or Avatar, people flying around dragons beating the shit out of each other. It's still, that is containable and understandable in a cinematic narrative, and I wonder whether we're actually underplaying what makes space opera so spectacularly wonderful is the literally unimaginable scale that you can only get in a book.
Yeah. There's the backstory as well, isn't there? There's a historical perspective. I mean, Star Wars is basically a war of succession. It's, you know, it's Prince Charles coming back from his exile on a gardening planet to fight, I guess, Prince Philip for the throne. Or maybe David Cameron in the helmet. I don't know.
That really makes the backstory unpleasant, doesn't it?
But that is space opera, isn't it? The space opera always has this dizzy, vast perspective, which Star Wars had with his crew. I always sort of thought George Lucas missed it out by maybe a bit in now of having some historical team excavating the ruins of somewhere and getting the story out from that, because it is a long time. It establishes it's a long time ago, and there's a lot of stuff happening a long time ago, which is why all the stuff you see is happening now, and that's also what the space opera had going.
Quite well conveyed, I felt, in the first film, that sense that we were, you know, a long time after the Old Republic. And of course, once Lucas has planted the idea of this grand heroic age in your mind, you don't want to see it. And I think that was the big mistake with the prequels, that he took us back to this time when the spaceships were shiny. You know, and everything did work, and it wasn't anything like as attractive.
It could never be as attractive as your imagination. Yeah.
Can I turn to my panelists on the left? Do we have anything to add? No? Well, moving on. Jane, would you like to say anything?
You're picking on me.
I'm going to ask you a question at some point anyway.
So I know, this is a
might as well ask it to you now.
I was actually going to say something, quickly, that a lot of the examples we've been coming up with, like Avatar, etc., they're space opera's little sister, Planetary Romance, which I like as well, but not quite the same thing. Go on, ask me the question then.
And of course, John Carter's coming out later in this year, which is the sort of the granddaddy of Planetary Romance, so it'll be interesting to see if that picks up any traction. I think there's a lot of money hanging on that film. It's ridiculously expensive, isn't it, John Carter? So I hear. And if that doesn't pick up the audience it needs, then that's really the name of the coffin.
The trailer looks pretty splendid, actually.
You've seen it, have you?
Yeah. The trailer. It looks wonderful, yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering, have you ever read The Moon Maid by Edgar Rice Burroughs?
No.
That's a kind of a sort of a weird. It's like. Like two characters locked in a death struggle. Only they die and they get reincarnated further down the line, and they're still at it. And it goes on for like three or four reincarnations. It's
really bizarre. I wanted to actually make a point about space opera as escapism, because I mean that's what that's a brick bag gets thrown at it a lot from, you know, various sort of cores of the mainstream and beyond, and saying that it's just meaningless entertainment. And I think that is completely wrong, because in a sense I don't think it matters. No matter what kind of genre writing you're making, you are providing a certain kind of escapism, but it's not escape. It's not escape from meaning. It's an escape into meaning, and that's a lot of what we do when we write science fiction space opera. Is that we're working with it with some quite strong sort of stereotypes and archetypes, and they have you know, all that meaning that's freighted along with them, and the whole thing that we write and we create is freighted with the meaning that we carry with us from the civilization we were born into, basically. So it's not meaningless escapism.
Escapism is a much, an overused term, I think. And there was a prominent fan in the field who said to me something along the lines of, if anyone ever accuses me of reading science fiction for escapism, I tell them what my day job is. And his job at the time was, he was a specialist in conflict resolution in the Balkans. So, say what you like about escapism. Aaron, do you have anything to add? one thing I just wanted to sort of touch on here was that we have this idea that there are SF properties that are sort of begging to be filmed, books that have been out there for a long time, have a sizable audience, and books that have been filmed perhaps imperfectly, we feel that their time is due and they must be done. But when we get a director who comes along like Cameron, someone with a real feel for the sort of language of science fiction, to some extent, I think they're more interested in putting their own visions up on the screen. And why would Cameron want to take someone else's property and film it when he can think up his own universe? Unfortunately, the directors who are with the best toolkits to do science fiction tend to be the ones who are least interested in adapting existing works. And I think if you look at, again, a director like Duncan Jones, who's clearly steeped in science fiction, his first film, Moon, showed that he had all the credentials to do sort of intelligent science fiction that wasn't based on an existing literary property. That was a conversation.
Well, I wonder why it didn't apply to fantasy as well then, because quite happily you take Tolkien and turn that into one of the biggest films ever. Why wouldn't you do that to Dune, or why wouldn't you do that to Doc Smith or something?
I would imagine that even the audience for Tolkien will always outnumber the audience for any comparable science fiction property. Perhaps I'm wrong, but I can't imagine that there are as many Foundation fans or Dune fans out there as there are Tolkien fans.
But
Dune's been done twice already. It's the film and the TV series.
But is there a perception that it hasn't been done properly and that the definitive Dune is still... It's still optioned, isn't it? You still hear about people planning to make Dune. Well, I think we need to allow time for questions, so we'll probably keep talking for another 5 minutes. I just want to ask the question to Jane. You are, I think it's been said that you're the only...
If you mention my gender, I'm
going to
kick you in the nuts.
Okay, I'm going to prepare for a right nut-kicking now. But, as a woman writing science fiction, writing space opera, what's your perception been?
That this is the question that men always ask me. Why don't they just read their key books?
Good. Yeah. All right. That's broken. We are always talking about the future of literary space opera, but this has been, we're sort of 20 years into the new space opera. Does it have a future? Has the sort of science fiction's focus moved on? Does anyone care about space opera anymore? What do the panelists think? You're still writing it, Peter, aren't you?
I just scraped in on your definition, yes. But that's the last one for a while, sorry. Do people care about it? I mean, it's a big enough audience we've managed to attract, so I'm assuming some people still find it interesting. As long as you can still produce relatively new, relatively interesting stuff, yeah. I mean, it's the reason I write it anyway. Is because of the widescreen break. You can shove whatever the hell you want to talk about in there.
as blatantly as you want or as subtly as you want, and that's why I love it, and that's why I will, after I've done my little break this year, I'll be going back to it, because of the possibilities it offers. Limitless.
You don't feel in any way sort of constrained by it?
No. If I have a plot for a contemporary novel, then I'll go ahead and write it. I probably won't sell many of them, but I'll go ahead and write it. But because it gives you this freedom, that's where I want to be.
Paul, can I talk to you a little bit about Paul's sort of three recent novels are... They have this space operatic moment, but it's maybe not the thing you're doing, right? It's sort of, yeah. It's hard SF with an interstellar or solar system setting. But
yeah,
I'm a bit
interested in the sort of new solar system that Cassini and all the other probes were revealing, and imagining what kind of people would live in those landscapes and how it would affect them living there. So it is romantic in a way, because it's very romantic to think that we're going to have human beings in the next couple of hundred years out there. Maybe it's the next 2000. But also, I just thought, well, it's one avenue for exploring what the future of the human species would be like, what happens if it starts branching off. And if you're thinking in terms of evolution, you're going to have some kind of stimulus, some kind of challenge for that. So I thought, well, let's go with that, and let's imagine what happens if you've got all these different environments. What will happen to the human species? How will it split up, and how will that affect, you know, future history? So that's the kind of thing I'm playing with at the moment. But there's also this huge metaphorical power as well, and also this there are lots of references back to, you know, the Choir War and things like that. Other fictions. The one I'm writing at the moment, Evening Empires, is all the sections, you know, the section Childhood Ends is the first section, the next section is Marooned Off Vesta, and so on and so forth. So you're referring back, you know, science fiction is always referring back to its own history as well. It's always in discussion with what's going on, and reframing it in contemporary terms. So I don't think there's any problem with that at all.
Do you ever find that critics or reviewers will sort of apply a space opera mindset when they're reviewing your stuff? They'll, you know, to some extent I've had it where they're sort of almost finding fault for what's not there because they're going in with this sort of space opera hat on. That there must be a certain amount of action in there. Well, if I'm not, you know, I'm not interested necessarily in writing that at the moment, just because there are spaceships and planets in there doesn't mean it's space opera.
Yeah.
I think we've lost that a little bit.
There's a big branch in America. There's a big branch of military science fiction, which is kind of space opera in a way, isn't it? I mean, you've got all the David Drakes and John Gringos and things like that. And I did get some interesting reactions. You know, I wrote a novel called The Quiet War, and people said, well, there's not a lot going on in it. Where's all the spaceship battles? Well, you know, it's the quiet war. It's a war of stealth. It's a war of subversion. It's the kind of net war thing that's going on in various countries around the world right now. You don't go out and put frontline troops against your enemy anymore. The first thing you do is try and bring their telecommunications network down, that kind of thing. There's one of the problems with science fiction as well. You've got this deep history, but there's also this sense that everything should be, which is, I find, odd in a genre that's supposed to be looking forward. It should always be harking back in the traditions you subvert. Why not? I mean, it's great to subvert traditions, and it's interesting to see filmmakers like Duncan Jones and so on playing with those traditions, and maybe something interesting will come after that, rather than making stuff that harks back to 1930s, 1940s science fiction. It'd be lovely to see some 1950s science fiction be made into films like, I don't know, Earthman Come Home, you know, James Blish Flying Cities series. That'd be great seeing New York up there flying across the galaxy. I mean, I'm sure there must be, panelists must think of some other works that, you know, classic works that should be done, and we can move on from that and think of new stuff.
I hope I'm not in for another nut-clicking game, but if I remember rightly, did you make the point that perhaps our lack of interest in science fiction set in space reflects the sort of perception out there that we're not achieving anything in the real world in terms of space exploration and space flight? Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
We seem to be at a stage at the moment where there was the whole dream of being an astronaut for my generation. It didn't happen. We're all a bit shamefaced about it. Budgets are being cut. We don't really like to talk about that. Yes, America won the race to the moon, and that was great, but really the political loading on that just makes us feel embarrassed. And as far as most of us are concerned, it was a dream. It's only there in fiction, if at all. Let's really not invest hopes in it. Obviously, when we find the Chinese have built a face on the moon, that's going to change everything. Not necessarily for the better. I was thinking about this, and there is going to be a risk that in 10, 20 years' time, if that's what happens, that there will be an association of space with the other, the enemy, because it is enemy territory. I think this is unforgivable, but I think it's actually quite predictable that Western culture is going to go off space something rotten if we see we've lost the space race to another country. And what the rest of the panelists think?
Yeah, I was going to say, yes, most of us grew up with the space race, but that was government agencies. There's a lot of the alt space crowd now that's starting to take over and come forward. It might well be the Chinese versus the alt space crowd in space, rather than, I mean, the high, Gerard O'Neill's high frontier is sadly probably not going to happen, but at least we're a bit more realistic about it now. And people like, what's his name, does SpaceX? Musk. I mean, he clearly wants to be the next man on the moon, if not Mars. And he's got the money and the talent to do it. Yeah. So although it's stalled, it's sort of branching out and taking off in another direction, which is my hope for it anyway.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a good thing to hope for. While we still have capitalism, let's use it to go and do space tourism and develop that way. But ultimately, I think it's going to be a state versus state thing rather than individuals.
Well, but to turn that around, though, would you then say that if there was, a significant resurgence of space exploration, which I think could well happen, I mean, particularly with people like Musk, his plans are extremely ambitious, and yet everything he said he will do, he has delivered. And I think by 2013, he will have the Falcon 9 Heavy will be the most powerful launcher since the Saturn V, capable of putting 53 tons into low orbit, which is incredible. You know, you can really start to build sort of your space wheels and things like that then, if you want to.
Yes, we're also, strangely for science fiction writers, we're also sort of focusing on chemical rocket technology. I mean, you know, it's only got to take one innovation, and we'll be up there with the greatest of ease. I'm still holding out for that one as well. But it's this looking at what we can do with what we have, the equipment of what we have got and have been doing. I think we have a responsibility, if you like, to try and project something more hopeful and try and project some more different technologies coming along.
Well, I want to allow time for questions, so perhaps I'll just ask the panelists just to, if you have a sort of concluding remark about the sort of state of space opera now, where you know, beginning with Aaron. We haven't heard enough from Aaron. I'm sorry about that.
I'm in the shadows. I don't deserve a table. I don't want to come across as the most ivory towerish dick on this panel, but I think a lot of the reason that it's failing recently is because it's so very bad. Like Avatar, you know, we got, oh good, we've had our one science fiction film for the last 5 years. Oh, it's shit. That's tremendous. I think that puts a lot of people off. I mean, that only harms us in the long run. Like, I started off saying I was a science fiction writer, and then at family parties, now I'm just a writer. And, you know, now I'm just some guy who misses deadlines. Like, I'm getting further and further away from the thing I actually do. So, I think essentially what we actually have to deal with, what the public's presented with, is harming us overall. Matter.
Well, I feel a lot of the stuff that's making out into the into the public arena is stuff that comes off the old baloney machine. It's you know, it's Hollywood producing and Hollywood financing, you know, basically rules the roost and determines a lot of the structure, the plot, the characters, how much baloney goes into the mix. And in this age of decreased expectations and lowered finance, those imperatives will have an even bigger say. So, but then again, I mean, the other side of it is the freedom of the digital age and the digitization of information that's out there, and the tools to make it is much more widespread than it was 10 years ago. So, for example, I mean, you've ever heard of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society? They've done a full black and white movie based on one of HBL stories, which I've ordered in DVD, I can't wait to get it. And I've seen the trails from it, it looks absolutely wonderful, and I mean, they definitely don't have any sort of a big funds backing at all, so yeah, I think that
I think we're on the cusp of seeing, you know, a big production coming from the usual sources at all. It's a question of whether something a big, well-made something from an indie can actually get access to the screens or that.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of crash bang plotless bollocks coming out of Hollywood, and always will be. But that won't stop us writing space opera, and I don't think it's a genre that's going to go away because it is such a broad church. It brings in so many influences. It can change the new space opera. It's like New Wave. It'll always be new space opera. So I'm optimistic that when they do finally realise that we've got some big ideas to play with, media will then come crawling back to us and offer huge option fees.
I think that the quality question I think does come up quite often, and I think it's often an issue of enormous quality in terms of the visualization of stuff, and as Peter was saying earlier, the story tends to get forgotten. And I think if we can encourage filmmakers who are investing $100, $200, $300 million in making a film, could they not spend a little bit of that on structuring it with something character-driven, so that when they deploy the extraordinary special effects, they are now, you know, on a very easy basis, capable of producing. They can show us almost anything they need to show us now. This is that watermark of about Jurassic Park, where suddenly computer animation meant that they could show us anything, and we would completely and utterly believe it. Could they not synthesize that with a story that was so compelling that when it happened, I think that's one of the reasons The Lord of the Rings is such a good example, because it's a good story and people want to read the story and see the story dramatically presented. The fact that it's presented so beautifully means that it works as a film as well as a book, and I think that's what's lacking, is that people invest. I mean, Avatar's a very solid film, but it's a very, 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 very simple and derivative story, and it seems an enormous shame that all that talent was put onto that flimsy carcass, and I think that is the case. And maybe there is, that's where my ridiculous comment earlier on about doing it like The Killing and doing 20 hours worth of television. Maybe television is the salvation of this kind of stuff. As special effects prices come down because computer animation makes things easier to render, maybe television shows will start looking cinema quality, and you will actually end up then be able to use the space as something like Battlestar Galactica did to tell a really compelling story that you just happen to present visually in a way that matches, say, Star Wars or something else. You know, maybe that's the sort of we're coming to that point through two different routes, and maybe technical achievement is finally going to be matched with the impetus of decent storytelling on television. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't add to that. I'll give it up for the questions.
Well, you know, I write novels, which is cheap to do, and is a kind of, most people, there are a few exceptions sitting to my left here, a marginal kind of existence, and that's fine because it means it gets overlooked and you've got a certain freedom that way. But picking up from what Mike and others were saying here, there's certainly a lot of interesting stuff coming out if you look on Vimeo and YouTube and so on, and there's monsters, you know. That was basically a one-man movie done very cleverly. And what we forget with all these movies with the big special effects is that you can have these movies with great ideas and with special effects tailored exactly to these ideas. And that was basically done on a laptop. So out there somewhere, there is probably somebody composing, you know, the next Star Wars, whatever, because, although we can say, you know, written SF is marginal in its influence on all of this, which seems to be one of the things that we're agreed on. Yeah, it does have resonance. You know, if you go to NASA, you have all the guys read science fiction when they're, and women all read science fiction, or most of them read science fiction when they're younger. Elon Musk read science fiction, that's what it's about, and so on and so forth. So it really do have an effect, actually. And I think because it's getting cheaper, and because, yeah, you can have these big movies with big special effects and big PR budgets, more to the point, but you've also got these films like Monsters, like Moon and so on coming out, and they're low-budget, high-end special effects movies, which is great, which is just what we want.
Well, let's take some questions then. Lady here, in the front. Oh, good, we've got microphones. Excellent.
Thank you. I have to admit, my guilty pleasure is playing several hours of Halo. I really enjoy gaming, especially when I'm missing my fix of space opera and I don't want to read a David Weber or a John Ringo. So none of the panel have actually mentioned gaming as filling that gap, that space opera gap in people's imagination. I would love to see a really good writer going with the Halo franchise and actually making a great universe that I can explore. What is
about
and think about the role of gaming?
Anyone want to pick that one up? Aaron.
I was just going to say, I think isn't Greg Baird doing Halo universe books? Yeah, I think it is. It's certainly one of the major franchises, and I think we're really terribly remiss actually not talking about gaming, because that is the natural extension, the graphics that are possible in a game now, which often have budgets that exceed the average movie, are capable of producing things and actually experiencing those things in a way that is much closer to the sort of thing that a space opera novel will do, more than a film can do. Obviously, Aaron and I both work for Black Library, which publishes novels that are based on tabletop games, which then by extension computer games as well, and that is unashamedly space opera and delights in it, and in fact we're constantly trying to find new ways of expressing the sheer indulgent pleasure of the melodrama of space opera in that form, because that's what it's all about. That's the entire reason for being, is to entertain you with the shockingly vast scale of things, and sort of the ingenuity comes in trying to find a way of doing that differently and more excitingly each time we do it, so the scale gets bigger and bigger and bigger. We are lucky enough to have a very, very big audience for that globally, and now that helps because it's based on a franchise that people are very enthusiastic about, but they're enthusiastic about it because it's doing that very thing in the way that Halo is and other things. So I think, we should have mentioned that earlier, actually. You've made us all look stupid there.
Aaron, just quickly, and then we'll take another question.
I think the problem with this is, having worked in video games, is you're in a process with 300 other people, and essentially a lot of the time, even as lead writer, I was lead writer on the game, and my ideas didn't necessarily mean shit for those 299 people. Because 10 will come back and say, oh, we can't do that. 50 will come back and say, we could do that, but it will cost too much. If you get this section to cut X, then we can do Y. Then another 100 guys just don't like you because you're a cocky twat and a beanie, and they say, we're not doing that. And then you'll have another part of the company that runs everything past the fans first, like on forums or whatever, secretly, or viral marketing or whatever, and they get feedback on, well, this isn't working, this is working. And you might have written the most glorious epic since Gandhi and the Fall of Troy, but it doesn't matter, because those 299 people have different ideas, and they're the ones who bring it to reality, like they're the ones who bring it to fruition. So you're kind of screwed, depending on how well you get on with people. And I was in Norway at the time, and I didn't get on that well with those people.
Is this Duke Nukem Forever?
And let's just take another question. Let's get one here in front of you. I'm sorry, we haven't allowed enough time for questions, so I apologise.
What do the panel think of Stargate and Hitchhiker's Guide as space opera?
Well, I'll just quickly say, I really enjoyed Stargate Universe. I'd never come to the Stargate franchise before that one, and I really enjoyed it. But from what I gathered, the fans, as a rule, were quite hostile to it and didn't like it. But I thought that was really excellent televisual science fiction. Maybe not space opera, but very, very good spaceship SF. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I definitely think Stargate's space opera. The only thing is, they haven't got ships, they've got gates. But it ticks every other box. And possibly Hitchhikers, but all too busy laughing to realise actually it's stealth science fiction.
Gentleman at the back there, number 6, I think, is it? Number 1.
I'm not too sure I came late to this party, but with the impending release of the John Carter of Mars and the Bryan Singer scheduled remake of the classic Battlestar Galactica, maybe we are seeing this reinsurgence of space opera. It may lead to Flash Gordon or perhaps Buck Rogers. Have you discussed John Carter of Mars? What do you think of it? Your thoughts on it?
We sort of discussed we didn't really know what it was going to do, but it might be important when it comes along. I didn't know about that. They're doing another Battlestar Galactica, is that right?
It still hasn't been fully penciled in as what it's going to be. It's going to either be a continuation of the classic series or a faithful adaptation.
Right.
Remake is not space opera anymore. So.
No. Okay. Yeah. Do we have another question from this side of the audience?
Gentlemen here, 4 rows back.
Given that in terms of cinema in recent times, there's been an awful lot of, say, superhero films and maybe urban fantasy mechanism stuff, Do you think maybe there's been a swing towards, a pendulum swing towards more personal scale material for a while? And is that maybe just something that's going to shift back with time as people get glutted on that and start looking for something in bigger scope again?
One of the things I think is worth pointing out, that the superhero is the superhero movie is clearly the in thing that for the last few years, and I think we possibly tend to forget that superhero stories, generally speaking, are space opera in slightly different spandex clothes. I did a lot of work for Marvel in the last few years writing their cosmic superheroes, where one of the things I liked about that was that I didn't feel I was writing superheroes. I was writing stories about people with post-human abilities who happen to wear uniforms or costumes the way they looked wasn't determined by the fact that they had to change the phone box and stop a train being derailed and that kind of stuff. So I think superheroes in comics there's a lot of superheroes that are involved in space opera type stories, and I think those are analogous to the sorts of stories that we often see. The scale is usually contained within Earth, which is the big difference, I guess. But things like Legion of Superheroes, Green Lantern, of course, is a cosmic superhero, and that was something that when I worked on the cosmic books for Marvel, they didn't think worked very well. It was a niche interest, but clearly I think it's breaking out when people are able to see the way you can connect those two things together and actually have something very, very grandiose. So my simple answer is I don't think seeing superheroes as sort of something replacing it on a personal level for a while. I actually think they're actually sort of it's what it's turned into briefly.
There's a question, gentlemen, here in the front row. I find there's a fair chunk of science fiction out there, fan-made stuff especially, that's not necessarily easy to find, but once you do find it, there's actually quite a lot of them. There are Star Trek fan groups that have literally made 5, 6, 7 seasons worth of things. The other thing as well is, again, stuff that's not necessarily quite as easy to find. Star Wars Clone Wars. I don't know if you've actually seen that, but that's very much...
The animated one.
Yes. Yes. Literally, yes. Space battles, war...
You're saying we're missing some good stuff. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Have you seen that, Peter? Have you seen the Clone Wars stuff?
No, I haven't. But I will be, because I have two small children, so they will be brought up on Star Wars. I know there's a whole lot of there's a whole branch of fan fiction that's doing it as well. Yeah, I was aware of that. But no, I haven't seen Clone Wars yet.
It wasn't even the first one. It was the Starship Troopers Chronicles.
Oh yes, we forgot Starship Troopers, didn't we?
All three of them.
Oh, film now, isn't it?
Oh no, three of them.
Yeah, we don't mention the last two.
Yes, no, we won't.
Well, I suspect we're near the end of our time now. So I'd like to thank, first of all, I'd like to thank everyone in the audience. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening to us. Much appreciated. And I'd like to thank my fellow panelists. Thank you for your time, everyone.
Hearty thanks to Douglas Saltmarsh for recording that panel for us. Don't forget, we're always keen to hear your thoughts, so leave us a comment on the blog, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email at impossiblepodcast@gmail.com. We'll have more commentaries, reviews and discussions for you soon. Until then, take care.